Hi, and welcome to a new episode of Ethics for a Changing World. We tend to think of ourselves as humans as the most intelligent species on Earth. But what happens if we create something like robots, which is smarter than we are? What happens to our sense of self? This is the first episode in a two-part mini-series discussing what it means to be human in the context of the developments associated in robotics. In this first episode, we're going to be looking at what happens when we treat humans as robots, when we just treat humans as cogs in the machine, as data points. And the second episode is going to be looking at the flip side of that. Rather than what happens when we treat humans as robots, what happens when we treat robots as humans? Who's doing it? And what are the social consequences of that? Today, I'm really excited to be talking to Dr. Beth Singler, who is the Junior Research Fellow in Artificial Intelligence at Homerton College, University of Cambridge, and also a guest speaker for New Scientist Live this year. We're going to be first talking about robomorphization, which is a term for treating humans as robots. We're going to be talking about why it's happening and its consequences. We're going to be talking then about what it means to be human if we're no longer the most intelligent species, and what we can do in response to that. Some people are tempted just to fall into fatalism, existential despair. But are there other responses? And finally, we're going to be talking about robot rights and what's wrong with the Star Wars films. And you'll see what I mean by that when we get there. If you like this episode of Ethics for a Changing World, be sure to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or subscribe on Spotify and recommend it to any of your friends. You can follow us on Twitter at Ethics Tech Pod and on Instagram at Ethics for a Changing World, where we have lots more content. Without further ado, on with the show. Hi Beth, thanks so much for joining us today. Could you just start by telling us a little bit about your work?
Yes, so I'm an anthropologist with a religious studies background, and I've moved from looking at new religious movements into artificial intelligence as a subject area. I like to summarize my research sometimes in a tweet length sentence, that I think about what you think about machines that might think. That one's quite handy when I'm off on stage and I need a quick way of saying what I'm up to. But basically, I pay attention to our interpretations, perceptions, and accounts of artificial intelligence, what kind of communities of thought we develop around it, what our hopes and fears for the future of artificial intelligence are, how it affects what we consider the human to be, and all those pernicious ethical and societal problems that come with artificial intelligence as well.
That's such a fantastic mix of things, and we'll pick up on a couple of things there. And I'm also really excited to talk to you from an anthropologist's perspective. We talk to a lot of lawyers and a lot of ethicists, so this is really interesting. We're going to start with, you've written a lot about the term robomorphization. Hopefully I got that right, which is a fantastic word. Could you just tell us what's meant by the term?
So this is the flip side of anthropomorphization, which we're probably a little bit more familiar with, the idea that we take the non-human and we see the human within it. So, you know, when it comes to machines in particular, because that's the area I look at, when you have a bipedal robot, you start seeing its more humanistic characteristics. You might think, oh, you know, it's doing something in a cute way, or it's scary in some way because it can do something that a human can do. And of course, we have lots of science fiction that deals with humanoid android forms. So that informs our perception of robots as being more or less human. And as I say, robomorphization is the flip of that. So seeing humans and considering them to be more machine-like. So we have a long history of metaphorical language about what the human is constructed out of. You can go back far enough and think about astrological interpretations of the human body as mirroring the cosmos. Or you come more recently, and the development of the factory in the industrial era gave us another model for understanding the human body, and the hydraulics and other different systems. And then more recently, with the computer age, we start talking about how the brain is a computer. computer, that we can upload and download information. And then with artificial intelligence, where the explicit aim is really to develop something that's human-like in its capabilities, that barrier between the human and the non-human becomes more fluid in our language. We start talking more and more about how the human brain is like an artificial intelligence system. And the outcome of this, and what I'm really interested in with robomorphization, is the limitations it puts on our treatment of humans, that the more we see them as machine-like or robot-like, the less we treat them particularly well. When that blurring of the lines between the machine and the human comes about, we're more inclined to see humans as parts of a larger machine, to treat them less well, to diminish their abilities and the messiness of human life into something that's much more algorithmically explainable.
And you mentioned one or two examples there. Could you just give us a couple more kind of concrete examples of where you see this happening?
So I think it's particularly predominant in areas where efficiency is reified, is treated as particularly important. So in the Amazon warehouses, for example, the operations of the human workers are timed, they're quantified, they're prescribed, they're given particular routes to work through in a way that is again pushing that barrier between the human and the machine, to the extent that at some point, I'm sure the operational ambitions of Amazon are to move entirely to a robotic workforce, because robots can work longer hours, they don't complain, they don't unionize. And you get literally protests from Amazon workers saying, we are not robots. This is the identity that they're being given when they're working in this space. But it occurs in lots of other places as well. It occurs in our assumptions about how different cohorts of students can be assessed based on previous cohorts at the same school, that this idea that we are in some ways reducible to the product of a same location, that we're just numbers in some way, you know, like the prisoner in early science fiction. If anyone's familiar with the prisoner, that I'm a man, I'm not a number. But this same sort of reduction of the human to its most simplistic mechanical machine-like form just adds to the detriment of the human flourishing.
So you said that you're concerned about the limitations this puts on humans. Could you talk a little bit more about the kind of negative consequences you see this bringing about?
Well, I just mentioned the school system. So this happened a couple of years ago back in the UK, that there was an algorithm implemented to predict grades because of COVID. Students weren't able to do their A-level exams. And this algorithm was predicated on the understanding, as I say, of school students being a product of their location. That if a school traditionally had not done well, then that information was into the system, and that meant the predicted grades would not be as high, even if the individual student had the capability to excel. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of treating humans as though they are collections of data or machine-like systems themselves doesn't allow for recognizing originality, creativity, or intellect that goes beyond what's expected. But, you know, it's part of a larger aspect of the capitalistic system that we live in, that we have immense amounts of data to deal with. And this simplification of the human into units is seen as the way to deal with that. And artificial intelligence both comes in as a solution to that problem, to deal with large sets of data, but also, as I say, provides a metaphor for how we understand humans, that we are likewise, as artificial intelligence is a part of a system and bureaucratization, that we can also be seen as a part of a system.
So if the issue then is with kind of treating people as data points effectively, do you see a way to make use of all this data that we've gathered in a constructive way, which is actually more beneficial to people?
Well, I think I would always trumpet the need for anthropologists, but also arts and humanities scholars of a wider set, that actually there are different forms of data that we can consider: ethnographic data, historical data, cultural data, that doesn't have to be as sort of narrowly defined as the algorithmic systems that we're employing at the moment. But it does, as I say, come from that grounding of seeing the human as more than a mechanical object, that's increasingly the metaphor that we are using, that is increasingly the approach that we're using. So it moves from simply metaphorical language to implications to how people are treated, how their life stories are understood, that whether we are just a set of data points or something a little bit more complex than that, and we need people who are experts in dealing with complexity and the muddledness of life, as well as data scientists and computer scientists.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and really powerful point. And something that you wrote about, which really made me think, was this idea that as humans, we tend to think of ourselves as the most intelligent beings. And so in fiction, for example, when we come up with fictional narratives about intelligent machines, they always end up looking like us. They always end up being very humanoid, because that's our kind of base model of what intelligence looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge thread of human exceptionalism, human essentialism, two ways of centering the human in our narratives that, yes, of course, if something's intelligent, it's going to look like us. There's a wonderful quote from one of the earliest figures in artificial intelligence who said, you know, that the technologists who started this endeavor of creating artificial intelligence back in the 1950s, that they looked around and thought about what smart people could do, that they could, you know, solve theorems and play chess. So if an artificial intelligence was going to be truly intelligent, it would have to do these things. But that's a very narrow understanding of human intelligence. And as you say, you know, a lot of the stories that we tell ourselves about artificial intelligence follow that line of thinking that says if we're, say, X levels of rational as humans and the smartest amongst us, who in these descriptions tend to be the same sorts of people, from the white Western men in particular, then anything we create that's going to be exponentially more intelligent than us is going to start off from that basis, is going to have that model as the starting point and move on from that, but still replicate some of those structures. I think there's some really interesting work being done in animal intelligence and consciousness that should give us other ways of considering artificial intelligence, if that's the direction that we want to go in, that actually models of intelligence don't just follow this very straight line of historical examples. There could be examples from the animal kingdom. And some people talk about swarm intelligences as well. Or we might think about other conceptions of the non-human from various different cultures as ways of conceiving of AI, or it, again, might be something that's beyond conception if it ever does arise in the way that we imagine it might.
And do you think that this idea of, because you said that a lot of your work has focused on kind of religion and anthropology of religion, does this idea of, is that where this idea of human exceptionalism comes from? Is it a kind of Abrahamic religious idea that's still embedded within our society?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when we say our society, obviously we're talking generally about the areas in which we perceive AI development to be happening, but it's happening around the world. So the cultural influences are very various. But certainly, yes, in the Western AI discourse, you can point to specific cases where a more monotheistic influence can be seen. So some of my work has been around looking at descriptions of AI as being transcendent or all-powerful and fitting into that sort of God space, if you like. So I did some work looking at people's expressions online of saying that they had felt that they were blessed by the algorithm in some way. So this might be a gig economy worker who's had a particularly good day. So if they're an Uber driver, they might say they've been blessed by the algorithm that day, or people who found content on YouTube or a particular song on Spotify was recommended by the algorithm, and this feeling of being blessed. And obviously that's a part of a heritage of language for people of a particular cultural background, that they're drawing on that. But you also see it in our aesthetic works as well. So when people illustrate articles about artificial intelligence in the future, sometimes they'll use what I call the AI creation meme, which is a remix of The Creation of Adam by Michelangelo from the Sistine Chapel. And this, again, it's not only drawing on our wellspring of existing theistic narratives and tropes, but it's also pushing those out and giving the viewer, the audience, the sense of where the AI story fits into a larger story of creation. Whether you're religious or not, it's going to imply that the creation of artificial intelligence is in some way as revolutionary as the creation of humankind. We can certainly recognize those narratives and myths, even if we don't hold to them. As myself, I don't necessarily hold to the creation story, but I see that that has an influence on our thinking about what AI is and could be.
Yeah, and that example you mentioned of being blessed by the algorithm, especially for kind of workers in Uber or some kind of organization like that, you can also see that this sense, as with religion, that it's something that we don't entirely understand. It's this all-powerful force above us that we don't really understand, but it's given us good luck today.
Well, it serves some interest to have a conception of the algorithm or artificial intelligence as being somewhat beyond conception and understanding. So, Elon Musk has warned about our efforts in AI as being an example of summoning the devil, summoning the demon. I can't remember if he said devil or demon, but this idea that there is something all powerful in artificial intelligence that we need to control, and his concerns about the existential risks of artificial intelligence also serve a certain agenda that he has in implementing very specific examples of AI under the control of his organization with his safeguards and boundaries for it. And it influences the wider conversation for the general public discourse. To have that conception in mind generates great fear, or if it's a very utopian model of artificial intelligence, great hope. And both of these emotions are being hacked, I suppose, that's another technological metaphor, but being hacked for various agendas. And we need to be very aware of what stories we're being told about artificial intelligence.
And then drawing those two elements together, that human exceptionalism, and you mentioned also the narratives that Elon Musk uses a lot. I mean, we think of ourselves as kind of the most intelligent beings in the universe. What do you think happens then to our kind of conception of ourselves if we create something that is, by some definition at least, more intelligent than us?
Well, we already have, in very narrow examples, and you can see the reverberations of those moments. So, when AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol, the response, and people slightly hyped up the response, so you have to unpack certain elements of it, but certainly the press response was quite dystopic. And even actually on the most small and incremental improvement in AI, the way that the press tells that story can be very dystopic. And I have a nice folder full of Terminator images used in the press that every time there's a story, we go immediately to the most darkly dystopian response. So you can see what happens already when we have an example of an AI that's particularly good at something, or a robotic form that can do something that human-like. So when Boston Dynamics videos come out quite regularly, people respond to those in very strong ways. They tend to be quite dystopian, but both dystopian and utopian. So we know what our human response is like, and that is partly fueled, as I say, by the press and the media giving a hyped-up version of what's happened. But if we proceed down this line of defining human capability around our human intelligence, and then we replicate that and improve on it, then you probably will see continuations of what I've called existential despair and concern. And some of this will be directly related to what they think are concrete outcomes of a superintelligence. So the existential risk arguments around AI in some way harming humans, taking over, the extremes of the science fiction robo-apocalypse. But it will displace a lot of people's certainty about their place in the universe, especially if, as automation improves, more and more humans are replaced in actual works. And that goes back to my comments on robomorphization, that the more you treat humans as machine-like and the more you see machines as human-like, that the blurring the lines between the two enable a swapping over from one to the other. So a lot of the progress in automations in factories and automations in driving is, a step towards the replacement of, say, the Uber driver, who is being treated as a part in a machine already and thus feeling blessed by the algorithm. The next step on from that is not just a car you can maneuver in space by dictating what the human driver should do. The next step would be the automated driver. So we can see this push towards less and less humans being employed. And that raises existential questions about what the human is for. Are we purely here to fulfill a job purpose? or are there alternatives? And then you get people talking about things like universal basic income as a way of still providing a livelihood for humans who've been displaced in such a way. But there's a lot of debate about whether that's practical or it works.
And then just on from that then, how do we, I mean, we, especially in the West, we've had the decline of religion for several decades now. Some people would argue we're in this kind of post-religious, like atheistic age. Whether you agree with that or not is a different question. But how do you think we should deal with and face that kind of existential despair?
Well, I mean, one of the I had this conversation the other day with someone. One of the things to respond to that is to say we don't have to go that way. We can collectively discuss what kind of future we want and decide in which direction we're going to go. We don't have to wholeheartedly absorb a sort of technological determinism that says we are fated for technology to improve in this particular direction to displace humans. We don't have to accept a capitalistic agenda that leads to greater and greater efficiencies requiring more and more robots. We can accept that we don't get our Amazon Prime deliveries the next day because we've decided that workers should be treated like robots. We can also choose not to use Amazon at all. These are all choices and options. There's some things that will be out of the general populace's hands, but political pressure and emphasis on regulation of AI in particular directions can have an effect. We can hold not referenda as such, but we can hold public discussions and we can lead to sort of a moratorium against particular AI uses. We had the same sort of discussions around gene editing and we decided in many countries that we just wouldn't go down particular routes. And of course, there's going to be agents outside of that, state actors and governments who are going to decide that they want to pursue this path, but we can collectively make decisions about what is a good and bad use of technology. We do it in war, we do it in biology, you know, we have these opportunities to have these discussions now.
I really like that response, and personally also very strongly against the kind of fatalism that you sometimes hear about technology. You've worked a lot on religion in the sphere of AI discourse, it's your specialism. Is this theistic kind of conception of AI that you've mentioned, is that common, and why do you think that is?
It's hard to judge commonality. I'm not a quantitative researcher, so I haven't, you know, done a massive data scraping of the internet to find out how many conversations are just framed in this particular way. But you can trace threads of it. You can see it in our science fiction. You can see it in our public discourse now. And like I say, I think it comes from having a collective cultural heritage. And again, it's very Western framed. There are other cultures that have a different theistic background or no theistic background or a polytheistic background rather than monotheistic backgrounds, that informs their understanding and conception of AI as well. And to go back to your point about the secularization of the world, sometimes this is framed as, you know, the response to that we have this void that's been left because religion is redundant and people are looking for other things. And this kind of discussion started, I mean, it's in sociology of religion, you see it in the 1980s where people started noting the variety of religious objects almost that people were picking up and choosing to adhere to and then dropping. And people started talking about a sort of supermarket model of religiosity that you could, you know, pick and choose. I think sometimes that's a little too simplistic, that doesn't really take on board the complexity of people's religious inspirations, that some of these things, as I say, are partly due to heritage and culture, that we have particular mimetic forms that are useful to think with. That if we're talking about creation, that of course we start talking about a Judeo-Christian style creation story, because that's what we're most familiar with in our general conversations. Even if you're not a religious person, this is the culture which you're generally steeped in. So that's an important part of it. It's like I say, it's difficult to quantify the influence of that. It's difficult also to quantify the influence of a theistic interpretation of AI on people's interactions with it. So when I highlight the blessed by the algorithm tweets and the volume of those is nowhere near, say, a a piece of disinformation that goes viral, and you can see hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of tweets about it. So it may be just a small example, or it may be something that's so diffuse that it's hard to capture in those forms of data collection. That's why being an anthropologist, especially a digital anthropologist, you're muddling around in anecdotal evidence that for the harder science is less conceived and less prioritized, but I think it's still very valuable evidence nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. And it very much, it makes you think, even if it's less kind of widespread, it makes you think about how people are thinking about these kinds of things.
Yeah. And for some people, I mean, this is very explicitly presented as theistic thinking. So some of my work as well is around sort of the development of new religious movements, transhumanist groups that are overtly intending a theistic interpretation of AI in the future, groups that emerge out of established religions that are bringing in artificial intelligence to their narrative, and also traditional mainstream religions that are also interacting with AI and whether that changes how they behave and how they do community, and not necessarily that they're then moving into theistic interpretations of AI, but then some cultures that's less of a problem to have artificial intelligence and robotics as a part of the wider cosmology of potential beings. So, you know, Hinduism and Buddhism, there's space in their conceptions of the world for AI and robots to be sacralized.
I read somewhere recently that you can now get, and it's not particularly widespread, but there are now Buddhist priests in Japan that are robots, because of their ontology and the way they think about religion and the gap between humans and machines is very different.
There is one particular example in Japan of Mindar, which is it's described as a bodhisattva, so an incarnation basically of Kwannon, the bodhisattva of compassion, and that was developed in association with the universities there. And I think it basically recites the Heart Sutra in the temple location. But there are other examples of robot priests as well. There's the Bless You 2 robot, which is more of, I think it was created in Germany. I just saw recently, I discussed this somewhere else as well, that there's a model called Leo Cole, who's also a computer scientist, and she's developed a robo-rabbi, which can provide, it's more about providing information. So there's these specific examples of the engagement of traditional established religions with artificial intelligence and robotics, and the Church of England here as well has got an Alexa skill that you can download onto your Amazon Alexa. So there's these particular examples of adoption of the technology by religious groups, but as I say, and I think you were making the same point, that there are different ontologies. The robot priest in Germany is not considered an incarnation of any kind of deity. It's a different theology. That wouldn't work. But there are questions about how the power and authority of a monotheistic god from a Western context is imbued and transmitted through a robotic form. And I've had some interesting discussions with religious believers about whether that's possible or not, or even the grander question of could robots and AI have souls? And some are very strongly opposed to that concept and some are more open to it. It does vary a lot, not just by religious group, but within religious groups as well.
It's such a fascinating topic. I was really interested by something you touched on earlier, which was you talked about developments in animal behavioral psychology. And it made me think about whether one of the issues with human exceptionalism is we place ourselves on a pedestal above all the other animals, and then robots then join us on that pedestal and it terrifies us. But should we be working to kind of also break down this clear barrier between humans and animals in terms of exceptionalism?
Yeah, I think most AI technologists that I've spoken to who've spent any time at all thinking about the nature and capacity of intelligence start having conversations about other non-human intelligences other than AI. They start exploring the potential for consciousness as that very nebulous, difficult to define term, but consciousness in other entities, including, they talk a lot about cephalopods, so squids, octopi, corvids, ravens and crows, their ability to problem solve. They also talk a lot about the difference that embodiment has on consciousness and how that might relate to AI and robots. So they'd imagine that our human consciousness in our embodied form is very much predicated on our bipedal, very strong sensor systems based in our hands, our eyes, our ears, our tongue, our taste, the main senses. And whether, say, for example, a corvid consciousness with its flight ability and its perspective on the world being so different to ours that we're ground-based, whether that would shape consciousness in a different way. And also as well with cephalopods, that they have so many different limbs, and those limbs appear to have some form of brain or mind ability within them separately to a central hub. And what kind of consciousness that might generate as well. These are, there's lots of people working in this area that have much more expertise in it than I do. But I think it's interesting to conceive of non-human consciousnesses around their forms of embodiment and what that might mean for AI systems. If hypothetically, very speculatively, we talk about their consciousness, what would that look like if they're distributed systems across the world performing tasks in various different embodied robotic forms? Does that change and shift their form of consciousness comparatively to humans? As science fiction obviously gets here way before a lot of the science does. So there's a few books like Kate Leckie's Ancillary Justice series has a distributed AI intelligence in a ship that has many bipedal android forms, and that consciousness sort of is differently structured because of that. So we can look to science fiction examples as well.
Yeah, I always find it interesting how essentially the science and technology world often draws a lot on science fiction. So it's not just that science fiction gets there first, it's that somebody will have read a science fiction book as a child and decides they actually want to make that when they become an actual scientist.
There's some really good research done by a colleague of mine, Sarah Dillon, specifically on what do AI researchers read, and looking into, she's from an English literature background and more things than that as well, looking into specifically the influence of the books, not just fiction, but also nonfiction that AI researchers have found influential. And she interviewed a certain number of people, and in those cases, it wasn't necessarily always a direct path from I read Asimov and I wanted to build a robot, but sometimes it's the moral and ethical debates within science fiction novels that really influence the direction they want to take their technological progress in. And I found that very interesting.
No, I hadn't thought about it like that. It's been really interesting chatting to you. I just want to ask one more question, if I may. In the context of robots, there's some discussion about what it should mean if we have very intelligent robots that do work. Should they have something akin to human rights? Should they be able to vote? Things like that. What's your take on this debate as an anthropologist?
So, this sort of comes into an area where it becomes very, very speculative, and it's difficult sometimes as an anthropologist to make kind of normative statements about what things should be like. I think the robot rights debate as it is now, before you even get to a stage where this becomes, something we really want to implement and have discussion about, well, where it is now, is often a way to highlight the rights of other non-human intelligences, that we have this conversation to highlight that we don't treat animals particularly well, and that actually if we're already on a path, we think, or people claim we're on a path towards greater and greater artificial intelligence, then we should perhaps have a conversation about how we treat existing intelligences. And I think you can throw that conversation back into the past as well, or actually still also the present in a lot of cases, and think about how we've treated human intelligences when we've encountered, and again, I'm using the we in the kind of white Western civilization we that I come from, to say in the past, we've encountered actual human intelligences and decided they were in some way deficient as humans and not deserving of the same rights as other people. And obviously I'm thinking about minority groups, indigenous cultures, and that you can extrapolate onwards for some people. You can extrapolate from our past mistakes and say, if we're going to encounter at some point artificial intelligences that are human equivalent or greater, that we should already be having this conversation about how we should treat them, that we should already be preparing for a future where we could treat another intelligence as a slave group. And again, science fiction gets there already. One of my biggest problems with the Star Wars films is the droids that we're very accepting that they have as much intelligence and personality, even actually some cases more personality than some of the lead characters in Star Wars, but they are a slave. They're in a slavery situation, and we just sort of accept that when we watch Star Wars. So likewise, the robot rights debate gets very much into this already. If that future ever arose, then that conversation will become more and more predominant, and we'll have to come up with some sort of solution to that. But again, it's predicated on a future where robots, artificial intelligence, have the exact same moral agency as we declare humans to have, or at the very least animals to have. So we have to know when that occurs. It's certainly not existent at the moment. Our narrow forms of artificial intelligence do not make requests. They do not act alone. They do not have agency and autonomy. So we've got those sorts of ideas of standards, but it goes, you know, we've got, again, a long tradition of determining when something becomes intelligent. The Turing test, which became a cultural touchstone for these things, then morphs into science fiction accounts like the Voigt-Kampff test, which is about whether something is human or not based on its ability to have empathy. So we have these standards that we think might work, but we don't know until this thing happens. But I remain, I think, mostly agnostic about the future of artificial intelligence and robotics and whether we will ever achieve something that has complete agential status.
That's a really good note to end on. Thanks so much for talking to us, Beth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. And remember to leave a like or review wherever you get your podcasts and to share this episode with friends. You can follow us on Twitter at @EthicsTechPod or Instagram at @EthicsForAChangingWorld. We've got lots more episodes that we've already recorded and lots more coming out. We've got the second episode of this mini-series with philosopher Dr. Joanna Malinowska. And then next week, we've got an episode coming out with Seth Villegas, whose work focuses on some of the themes that we've picked up here in terms of religion, AI, and also transhumanism. That's quite prominent in Silicon Valley. And we also have an episode coming out next week on artificial intelligence in Africa, which I'm really excited for you to listen to. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again next time.